Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Stephen Morabito. Poet and fiction writer Stephen Morabito is professor of English at the University of Pittsburgh's Greensburg campus, where he teaches in the writing program. A former NEA fellow, he is the author of three full-length books of poetry, The Oswego Fugues, Communion of Asiago, and most recently, Lowering the Body, all from Star Cloud Press. He lives in Salzburg, Pennsylvania, with his wife April and their four children, Angie, Stella, Tony, and Sebastian. Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Hi, Jan. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on Prosody. We've been talking about this for a while, and it's a good time to have you because you have this great new book, Lowering the Body, which you're going to read from.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Lowering the Body is the third and last Oswego Trilogy manuscript, and it really is saying goodbye to the old neighborhood, and the cover of the book is, the old grocery store that we had. The poems themselves are necessarily, made up, but it's a very, very real place. I'd like to open up with differing versions. The hellish black cloud drew breath over our corner grocery. This was 1963. 8th Street still tells of it today, how the boy climbed to the top of the blue Buick broad-shouldered delivery car and howled up to the black sky, "No, no, no, this place is ours. You cannot wash it away." Customers gathered outside and laughed until Grandma Z knelt with bread and cured olives, turning to Sicilian chants as the sun burst over him, setting rusted chrome ablaze. Those left say he spoke in tongues, stilling thunder with such blood. Some say the clouds parted when his arms dropped into silence. Some say his hands were wingtips as he flew down the back hood to disappear up 8th Street. But one insists he stayed there, head lifting into his life. Either way, they all agree that two-toned Buick Special shimmered and burnt to the touch for days. The next poem I'd like to read is called Eating Pepperoni on Good Friday. And, of course, when you grew up as a Catholic, you did not eat pepperoni on Good Friday. So this is a poem about stealing a stick of pepperoni. After stealing the magic stick from my father's meat case, I tried to think of where to go, not into the closet off the kitchen where the smell will hang with that of salty boots, not down to the cellar with webs on my face, or out back to the 50 Buick. I must go where only my punishment can follow. I go up to the roof, high over 8th Street. Only God above the oaks can spot me. The weight of my sin, hard in my hands. Oh, I know it's terrible to eat Pastucci Brothers on Good Friday. Everyone in dark rooms, the thin Bible pages turning slowly to the sorrowful mysteries. And I'm caught as the chimney stack hisses red with anger. Okay, okay, I accept it. I will pick each sandy grain from every last rooftop on 8th Street. I will be sentenced to an eternity of shingles, standing here forever, veils of steam from Friday flounder rising without me. Yes, but first this bite. Teeth breaking, salty skin, smell drifting straight up to heaven. The next poem is the title poem called Lowering the Body. And this imagines the young boy at his grandmother's funeral, where he actually is the last person in the funeral home after all the names have been called. And of course, when a body is lowered, it's lowered into the grave, but first it's lowered into its own casket. That's something that not a lot of people know. And of all the poems, I think this is one of them. This is probably one of the two or three that are actually autobiographical. This is called Lowering the Body. Once upon a time, on the corner of West 4th and Oneida, a boy was somehow locked in a funeral home bathroom. He was lost in brassy wonderment, to the roll call of the grieving, and the door, older than creaking bone, slept on its hinges and shut its keyhole eye. Then the archway yawned him out to stand among empty chairs and peek from behind a curtain as the director cranked the coffin, lowering the grandmother's body into the seal of the closing lid. And in his collapse, he fell with her into flowers, the world piercing his heart, into the doors of sleep as he discovered the dark, carpeted weightlessness of death. And so that's my way to say goodbye to the people of West Athe and Oneida, although there's funnier poems than that as well.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Stephen Morabito, and he's reading from his new book, Lowering the Body. Can you talk about, you know, what's involved sort of in writing a memorial to a sense of place, if in fact you see the book that way?
I do. I'm a writer of place in my fiction and in my poetry. You know, Marianne Moore has a very famous quote about poetry. It's one of the most famous. She said that poetry is imaginary gardens with real toads. You know, and I think that that can be very true. But for me, I think poetry and fiction are a little bit the other side of the coin. They are imaginary frogs. The characters are made up. But the places are very real. I think the places are what make poetry and fiction and literature for so many readers. And I've always been that kind of a reader. I wanted to be transported to another place. I also think that places have a kind of familiar magic. It never leaves you. I will never forget the sawdust, the knives, those kinds of things, my father's meat counter. And we kind of owe it to them when we capture that in our poetry. I think that we owe the return of those things. And it's not just a return, it's a celebration, and it's a kind of, hopefully, a memorial that will last for a long time. I think that's what art is, especially if you're class conscious, as I am, in terms of the working class people that I write about in my stories and poems.
Well, okay. You said that there's only maybe two or three poems in the book that are autobiographical. One was the title poem, Lowering the Body. And yet in other poems, like in the Pepperoni poem, you have the Pastucci brothers and you have all these rich details. And how do you have any kind of internal barometer by which you balance this this loyalty to fact and imagination? How do you sort of decide, you know, when you need, as a human or as a poet, to be factual?
I think that there's an ethical thing in me that believes that creative writing means that you create the whole thing. And I try to do that in my work as much as I can. I think that the barometer is a matter of assembling a line or assembling a paragraph. But I also think that the barometer is really kind of ethical and deep. I mean, you want to give this real experience back, but it doesn't have to be the experiences that people lived through. Because I don't think life is that interesting that you could fill a book with everything that really happened. I think there has to be a kind of way in which you add things or make things up. I think if people recognize, yes, that's my grocery store. Yes, that's what it was like. When did that happen? I don't remember that happening. and that's okay. It never happened. But the time happened and the truth of it happened. And I don't know, the expression is that, you know, poetry and fiction are, you know, the lie that tells the truth. And I think that we can hopefully measure our craft and our art by the size of the lie. And then the size of the truth. You know, he made that up. She made that up. You don't have to go on Oprah and take it back. You know, and I think we live in a world where there's a desperation to finish a book or to have a book published. And I think that it leads people down a kind of a road where ethics are questioned. in the creative act. It's a multidimensional kind of aesthetic that I have, I hope, and part of it is all of the above that I've said, but the deepest part of it is, you know, to give the thing back.
Right.
To a community.
Okay. Could you read some more poems?
I'm going to read one that's a little longer. It's called My Mother Joins the Hippies, and I'm happy with this poem for a number of reasons. One, when I wrote it, I knew the book was done. It's not the last poem in the book, but it comes toward the end, and it talks about how the hippies come down off the hill of the college to have this protest. And the protest is that a pregnant school teacher has been given a furlough. And until about 1967, if you were a pregnant woman, you could not teach grammar school. And not a lot of people know that. And when I found that out, I know that that kind of thing would have irritated all the ladies in the neighborhood because I grew up around strong women. This is called My Mother Joins the Hippies. They came down from the hill of Oswego State again, frayed bell bottoms, flowing hair, a river of tie-dyed acid colors, headbands, peace necklaces, granny sunglasses, beads, vests, boots, sandals, and braided leather belts that made them look like the Franciscans who taught us Sunday school. The hippies turned south off bridge and silently carried their signs on 8th, moving past the store, emptied now of awe-struck customers who clung to their wrapped roasts, their quarts of milk, their pounds of olives, their loaves of bread, who clung to the corner of West 8th and Oneida itself. This time it wasn't the latest LBJ troop surge in Vietnam, and the City Hall sit-in with its chants of make love, not war, that produced the Oswego 9 still awaiting trial. No, this time the hippies protested because our own Mrs. Thompson, down on Mohawk, had been forced from her second-grade classroom at Layton Elementary. She was 3 months pregnant and showing when the story broke in the neighborhood. It moved woman to woman, yard to yard like a swarm of angry bees, and my mother's dark Polish face hardened from beauty to political outrage. Politics is bad for business. Stay out of it, my father yelled into the wall behind the meat counter. Those aisles kept them from killing each other when they disagreed. They waited until it was only us kids. He was in the produce aisle pretending to straighten heads of lettuce, and she was in the canned goods aisle pretending to block the shelves. They shouted to each other things they could never discuss at home. His arguments rounded displays of Del Monte peaches. Her retorts bounced off boxes of Kellogg's cornflakes, and the air inside the store was somehow the final arbiter. They taught us fair exchange, one finally turning silent, nodding, picking up a broom, and sweeping forward for us all. But that time, her checkout counter, she ignored him by stocking Nestle bars, Teaberry gum, and Marlboros, while insisting to customers, right is right, wrong is wrong, and there's nothing wrong with a pregnant woman teaching second grade. Then she whipped that rotary dial phone until she stood, informing our principal, well, then shop elsewhere for your liverwurst and monk's bread. It took months for my father to learn she had banned Dr. Berlander, but it only took 2 seconds for her to cross A Street in her uniform, carrying the grocery stamper higher and higher like some kind of baton. Mrs. Berlin, Mrs. Ferraro, and Mrs. Grimaldi joined the hippies, too. They shook hands, talked, and nodded, no one looking a bit out of place. They would chant all the way down to Dr. Berlander's house on 6th and Utica. Customers looked to my father to do something, but then ambled home. He shrugged his shoulders, ushered us inside, closed the store for the day, went behind the meat counter, and cut down a hanging provolone. He nodded as he carved away the wax, kept on nodding as he sliced Genoa, tore bread, poured olives, and opened up bottles of pop and Genesee. Stretching on the sawdust, he addressed the remaining 2 cheeses. This one talks but says nothing. This one says nothing but knows everything. My brother Mike wanted to know, so how come they get along? Go figure, my father said. Maybe it's a bigger window than they know. Of course, we had no idea what the heck he was talking about. We just giggled as his story grew with the voices of knives and saws and scales. His hands opened, and he looked like Grandpa Z so much that I ached. But only until the sharp cheese and rich olives filled the air, and the first sweet burn of Coca-Cola swept it all away.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Stephen Morabito, and he's reading from his new book, Lowering the Body. Our listeners out there might be getting hungry right about now.
I hope they are. Hungry to read the book.
With the provolone, Genoa, olives, etc.
And Genesee.
I like how the meat counter figures prominently in the poem. And of course, the the sense of time, family, and rich detail is just really, really terrific in these poems.
The meat counter was like a confessional. It was like a secular confessional. People would come and tell him all kinds of things that he did and didn't want to hear. And the store, metaphorically, that grocery store, and so many lost grocery stores no more, that was a turnstile. My father got a letter years and years after he closed the grocery store. And it was a man paying him back the money that he owed him. And my father never went after people. He gave people food, when they were. And it was just a different kind of thing, and it's gone. Mm-hmm. Or at least it's largely going.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
The kielbasa, the places where you can go still get homemade, things like that.
Mm-hmm. When you were introducing this poem, you said when you wrote this, you knew the book was finished.
Mm-hmm.
How did you know that? I mean, did you really want this story to be told in this book?
Or? Yeah. What happened was I was, thinking about one, maybe two more poems that capped the whole idea of saying goodbye. And I realized when I wrote this poem and when I was writing it that this was the poem that really said goodbye, really showed the neighborhood dramatically, and not in a narrative way, but in a dramatic way, in a narrative way, showed the neighborhood going away. I mean, those people are clinging to the corner. Here comes the future. Here comes the hippies. But for one moment, because they have a common cause, the strong women in the neighborhood can join the hippies, and nobody can figure this out because, I grew up in a college town and there were two takes on the hippies. They were crazy, leave them alone, or they were good people, really good kids. They pushed me out of a ditch and this kind of thing. You'd hear stories in the store. And I just think that poem, when he cuts down the provolone, that as much as anything says goodbye. That says the place is changing,
mm-hmm.
and it's dying, and, so you capture that moment.
Mm-hmm. There's a serious sense of witnessing also, mm-hmm. in telling this story, mm-hmm. and regardless of how much is technically, true or accurate, mm-hmm. it does really bring up a time of change in a lot of other communities. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about feedback you get from this poem or from your book, from maybe some older people who maybe, I don't want to stereotype, but, from people who may not always latch on to poetry so quickly?
I think that relatives who read the poems, like them. And I did a poetry reading at Tay Cafe not too long ago. And when I was done, someone reached and said to me, I was there. And I thought for a moment, do I know you? I mean, I had that real kind of dissociative moment of the floor was moving and the room was spinning and there were tears in her eyes. And a couple of people came up and said, my father had a grocery store. My father worked at a grocery store. It was a Kroger's and we did this, we did that. So I really think that the imaginative manner takes it out of the egocentric kind of a forum of the writer and puts it into a story that people can relate to, because it's, you're not always referring to an I and me, my, it's, maybe a first person witnessing account, an act of retrieval in that manner. But there's a kind of universality that I think is born of the story. And yeah, I have had those kinds of responses.
Mm-hmm. And I love also how you were talking about class before, and I love how this book reaches out in that way and, to working class readers or to people who forget about the working class and include and speak to because there's still that image of poetry that unfortunately, a lot of people have that, oh, it's not for me, it goes over my head, et cetera, which is just not true. And it's, you know, poetry's for everybody. So.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, I had a friend one time who came home. We lived together, roommates in college, and I was playing Rachmaninoff, and he stomped out of the house. And then he came back another couple of days later. I was still playing the same Rachmaninoff piano concerto. And he sat there and listened to the whole thing and tears in his eyes. And he said, what was that? And I said, well, that was the Rachmaninoff you walked out on 3 days ago. And I just think if people give it a chance and realize that it's a real person, maybe we're professors and such, but you know, we're people, and we've never forgotten. You know, we don't live these lives in these ivory towers or these stereotypes. We roll up our sleeves, and you know, we never left. And I think that's why we're poets. Mm-hmm. You know, we really never left. I've never left 8th Street.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you read some more, please?
This poem is called "This Is My Ode." We weren't allowed to let Uncle Ted into the kitchen, just give him a new Jenny in the living room. Oh, this is my ode to the sweet, foamy head of 60s psychotherapy. But no, a cook on early retirement, he'd lose his balance, go astray, as Cousin May said. Like when Ted cleaned fresh clams in the dishwasher. Oh, this is my ode to all those sudsy yawners, my ode to the perversion of soapy grinners, my ode to that trigger inside us all, moved by what? The mention of pastrami or a dead wife's name? I saw it when he was behind the deli, when the fire department ordered pastramis, and someone mentioned Aunt Peggy's name. Oh, this is my ode to heaping mayo on corned beef, and my father storming out of his own store, bells howling at the door. Ted didn't even appear to like the thing he'd made. He simply stood there on the sawdust and regarded it at arm's length, eyes saying, no, this isn't the piece I had thought, but if I flee the world far enough. Oh, hear me now, this is my ode to a man setting down a sin of a sandwich and calmly walking away, not one white hair out of place. This is my ode to cold and entombed pain, to Ted in the intersection of West First and Bridge, the don't walk sign freezing him in his steps, the world blowing its horns of forced stillness and outrage, and a man whose wife dropped dead at her ironing board, and he said that over and over to the cops in their cruiser as the people paused with their hands up to their mouths or their Palladium Times folded under their arms. This is my ode to the biggest pastrami sandwiches I've ever seen, gaping smilers with tongues hanging out like the tired runners we were that day, all the way downtown with our layers and layers and layers of meat, mustard and cheese, and the Dortmunder pickles fished out. I carried the Campbell's soup box into the police station, and we fed the cops, who said not to worry about it, just give him a Jenny and help him calm down, that they knew him for years as the cook over at Vona's, how he and his wife shared a hot pastrami in the back booth on Friday nights. Oh, this is my ode to the one cop's simple logic with mustard on his chin and the rest of their happy mouths sinking into those monstrosities we walked out into the blistering August afternoon of 1965. Ted, like a child holding my hand, how such strange flesh engulfs your soul. We got him back home, and my father turned at the door, looking cold and confused as he returned to his orders. This is my ode to those eyes, those wordless eyes, as I handed Ted the beer in the cool, doilied, brown-bottled darkness. This is my ode to the way he took it, sipped it, then lowered his head. To the way I looked at my mother and my cousin May, who both stood looking from the dining room, to the way the sun burst in through the latticed Venetian blind, igniting their colorless work clothes, igniting their dark arms, igniting their paused, pondering faces, igniting for me, for the first time, more than those resilient olive faces.
Nice poem. It seems to me, you know, just hearing you read more and more of this, that The whole book is like a love poem.
Yeah, it really is. It's, you know, saying goodbye to a place, saying goodbye to people. And I remember when we went home the last, second to last time, it was probably about a year and a half ago, and I hadn't been home for a while in between that. One of the family friends I saw at our house, I said, have you been down to West 8th and Oneida? And her face changed, and she said, don't go there. Mm-hmm. But I did. And I keep thinking one day I'll go there and knock on the door and give someone a six-pack and $10 to let me walk through the old house the way I think it was Radio Days, the Woody Allen character does the same thing. But I walked around to the backyard, and it's the same, but it's completely different. It looks obviously nothing like this.
We have time for another poem.
Okay. This is the very last poem in the book, and it just simply is about the, you know, imagined day. There had to have been a day when, you know, my father closed the store for the last time. It's called Sabby. His name was Sebastian. Is Sebastian. It's called Sabby Closes the Store. There had to be a final customer, one last sold American from him, all smiles as anyone would remember. Maybe Casper across the street stopped in to shoot the breeze and find out for himself if what he heard down at the Elks Club was true. Or Mrs. D picked Campbell's from the shelf and he tossed in a box of saltines, too. I'd like to think it could have been his wife taking juicy fruit and flipping him a dime, that they talked more about their love than their strife, and that they thanked each other for the time. I'd like to think that he wasn't alone when he locked up, rounded 8th, and came home. And a poem that imagines what it was like to be on the farm. My grandfather and grandmother were onion farmers, and my dad came in off the farm and bought a grocery store. This is Vittorio and Concettina. He loved her with the purity of November snow, blanketing the black earth of his onion fields. He loved her with the restlessness of a farmer harvesting the days, for all for her stove, her face, her hands. He loved her with all the grace that came poured in her minestrone, that sudden burst of Roma tomatoes in Sicilian eyes.
It's the poetry of Stephen Morabito, and he's reading from his new book, Lowering the Body. Thank you so much, Steve. It was
great.
Thank
you for having me, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.